Okay, reminding us of a sort of overview of the mineral physics part of the program, we've looked at sort of an overview of the Earth from a mineral physics perspective. Yesterday, Abby gave us a overview of crystal structure of mantle minerals, and today what I'll do is look at thermodynamics. And thermodynamics provides a bridge between some of the stuff we've been doing so far, which includes phase equilibria, phase transitions, and so on. You looked at that quite a bit in the first laboratory exercise. And the next part of the mineral physics program, which focuses in on the physical properties of individual minerals. Thermodynamics gives us the basic set of tools for investigating both of these things, both the phase equilibria of multi-component, multi-phase systems, and the physical properties of individual minerals. Thermodynamics gives us the framework for both of those things. So let's say a little bit more about the scope of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is an unusual kind of physical theory. For one thing, it's applicable to any system, and I really do mean any system. It has been applied to black holes. This is one of NASA's renditions of a black hole, or what it might look like, as well as to a quartz crystal, as well as to living organisms, you name it. But, of course, nothing is for free, and thermodynamics purchases that great generality at a certain cost. And some of those costs are that thermodynamics is only applicable to a certain set of states called equilibrium states. I'll say a little bit more about this, but equilibrium states of a system are those that don't change with time and that therefore are independent of the path by which you got to them. Thermodynamics is also only applicable to certain properties of those states, and we'll look at what I mean by macroscopic properties of a state a little more in a bit. Also, thermodynamics is unusual for a physical theory in not providing specific quantitative predictions of particular properties. Okay? You can't use thermodynamics just by itself to predict what the equation of state of perovskite would be. You have to supplement it with particular information about the specific material you're working on. Instead, what thermodynamics gives you are limits, bounds on the possible values that certain properties can have, and it also gives you a set of relationships among properties that you might think naively would be completely disconnected from each other. So, for example, the entropy and the thermal expansivity turn out to be very intimately related, and that's just one example of many of the relationships that thermodynamics allows you to make. And that's actually very important for the Earth because it does allow you to extract as much information as possible out of a particular experimental measurement, all of which take a long time and sweat and blood to take, of course, especially at high pressure. So let's look at this idea of equilibrium in a fairly specific Earth context. What we have is a garnet peridotite here on the left, such as you formed in the first laboratory exercise. You saw that at over a certain range of depths, you had the phases that were existing were garnet, orthopyroxene, clinopyroxene, and olivine, and this is the rock that you were making in that first laboratory exercise. Let's think about two different ways of making that rock. You can start from shallower depths, where spinel is the aluminous phase rather than garnet, and you can have that spinel peridotite sink downwards, maybe in a subduction zone or something, and as it does so, the spinel will undergo the phase transformation to garnet, other phases will be involved, and so on, and you'll make this garnet peridotite. You could also just as well start from a perovskite, which is this terrible term that one would use for a perovskite-dominated rock, and if that rock, say at the core metal boundary even, has the same bulk composition, that is the same relative amounts of silica, calcium, alumina, magnesia, iron, as our garnet peridotite, and as it came up in an upwelling or a plume or whatever, and got to the same pressure temperature conditions, you would get the same thing, okay? It would also be a garnet peridotite. Okay. The conditions here are that the final pressure, temperature, and bulk compositions for these two paths are the same, and as long as those conditions are met, what you'll end up getting is a garnet peridotite in both cases. Okay, so equilibrium means a state that is independent of time and therefore independent of path. So the details of the initial condition, how the material was initially formed or set up or manufactured, the memory of those initial conditions eventually is erased and you come to some time-independent equilibrium state. And those are the states that thermodynamics deals with. Okay, what particular properties of this garnet peridotite will be independent of time and independent of path? In other words, will be the macroscopic properties that thermodynamics deals with. Some examples would be the density of the rock, the total entropy of the rock, add up the entropies of all the phases, that's going to be time independent, path independent, the total energy of the rock, the proportions of the phases, the compositions of the phases, the physical properties of each individual phase, all those things will be independent of time and path. Some things that are not macroscopic properties the thermodynamics cannot tell you anything about are the crystal size and shape. Obviously they vary quite a bit from one phase to the next. The garnets tend to be big, the olivines and pyroxenes tend to be small. Won't tell you anything about crystal shape. It won't tell you anything about the details of the arrangement of the garnet versus the olivine versus whatever else. Even though it's not obvious, and even though you can measure all these things from a macroscopic sample, all these things are really fundamentally microscopic properties that that arise from the details of the arrangements of the atoms in the initial sample. All right? So why did the garnet form here and not somewhere else? Well, it just so happened that there is a slightly greater tendency of aluminum atoms to concentrate in this region, and that formed a nucleation site for the garnet to form. Okay? So it came down to some very specific details of the coordinates of the atoms in the original sample. All right? And those microscopic details of where the atoms were at any time is not something that thermodynamics can tell you about, anything about. In fact, the whole machinery of thermodynamics was developed before we knew anything about atoms. All right? That's one of the remarkable things about thermodynamics. All right. We'll come back to the relationship between macroscopic properties and microscopic properties later and show that you can relate one to the other. We're still going to have trouble dealing with things like crystal size and shape and so on, but we will see some of the relationship. By the way, things like crystal size and shape can be interesting if you're interested in how rapidly this rock formed, or if you do want to know whether it came from shallow depths or great depths, then you might want to try to understand that some more. One of the challenges of thermodynamics is that there are a lot of quantities to keep in your head. And all of these are important geophysically, or almost all of them. And so it's important to have a feeling for each of these. What I want to give you is a way of looking at thermodynamics that systematizes or organizes all this information. In particular, what I want to do is introduce the idea of a fundamental thermodynamic relation, a potential from which everything else can be derived, okay? A single functional relationship from which you can derive everything else. It's very easy to get lost in the zoo of different variables, and in many treatments of thermodynamics, the relationships are not obvious. One way of systematizing these, before we get to the good stuff later, this is just sort of heuristic, is between second-order and first-order thermodynamic properties. The second-order properties we've seen in Bruce's talk and in other talks already, the heat capacity, thermal expansivity, bulk modulus, Grüneisen parameter, we've seen all those. And all of these involve derivatives among what I've called here the first-order properties. And the words second and first will become clear in a minute why I've used those terms. These are the first-order properties here, volume, entropy, amount of components, pressure, temperature, chemical potential. Those are the first order properties. Okay, as the sort of terminology sort of hints at already, underlying all this are a set of zeroth order properties. These are called the thermodynamic potentials. This is actually reminiscent of a lot of fields of physics, where you start from forces and then you realize that all these different forces and velocities are actually the result of some underlying potential which you can take spatial or other derivatives of to extract the forces and so on. So in geodynamics, the potential would be the stream function, for example. In gravity, you can talk about the gravitational force or the gravitational potential. Okay, so thermodynamics has much the same thing. There are thermodynamic potentials from which you can derive all this stuff by taking derivatives. First order properties of first derivatives, second order properties, second derivatives. Okay, let's back up a little bit though, and let's look at the foundations of thermodynamics. We have a particular material, and it's in equilibrium, and what we want to know is what do we need to specify to define that equilibrium state? What defines that equilibrium state uniquely? It turns out that you only need three quantities to do it, to define an equilibrium state uniquely. You need the number of atoms of each of your components, n sub I, okay? That makes sense. You need to know what the composition is, what type of material you're dealing with. You need to specify the volume, that is some aspect of the geometry of the system. How much space are these atoms taking up? And you also need to specify the internal energy, which gives you some notion of thermal effects, okay? How things depend on temperature, how the atoms are moving around, the dynamics of the atoms. Now, one way to explore this idea a little bit more, that you only need these three variables to describe the state of a system, is to look at a really simple system, okay? And the reason I'm looking at the ideal gas is that you can work out its properties really easily. You can go through the same argument for a crystal, but it would be much harder, basically because the potential energy is so important, okay? For an ideal gas, it's all kinetic energy and things get really simple. Okay, so for an ideal gas, the internal energy is just the kinetic energy of the atoms, all right? So it's just the sum over the kinetic energies of the individual atoms. Each of these atoms is zipping around at hundreds of miles per hour. For instance, the air in this room is doing that. And the internal energy is just the sum of the kinetic energies. All right, now, there are lots of ways of redistributing that kinetic energy over the atoms in the box while keeping the total internal energy exactly the same. Okay? So you can slow this one down and speed this one up by the same amount, and the overall internal energy will remain the same. You can count the number of ways of doing that, of redistributing the kinetic energy over the available atoms while leaving the internal energy unchanged. And we'll call that omega. And this omega then goes into something called the entropy. Okay, so you can calculate the entropy of the ideal gas just by counting that quantity. How many different ways are there to redistribute the kinetic energy among the atoms? I've oversimplified this a little bit because another contribution to the entropy, to omega, and therefore to the entropy, would be spatial rearrangements of the atoms. Okay, you have to count those as well. And the way to count, the way to calculate omega in this case is not trivial. We'll come back to another case where it's a bit easier to count what omega is. Anyway, this omega depends on the volume of the box, okay? It depends on the number of atoms you have in the box, and it depends on the internal energy, right? And so the entropy is some function of these three variables that we need to characterize the equilibrium state. Now we can think about how the internal energy and entropy are related. We can think a little bit about this functional relationship, how they might be related to each other. If the internal energy is very high, there are going to be many, many ways of rearranging the kinetic energy among the constituent atoms. There's a big energy scale to play with. You can change the kinetic energy of any one atom among a whole slew of different kinetic energies. As the internal energy goes to zero, though, you're going to be much more limited. If the internal energy is very small, in fact, if it is zero exactly, then every individual atom has to have exactly zero kinetic energy. And there's a lot less ways of rearranging the kinetic energy. In fact, there's only one way to do it. All right? There's only one way to arrange the kinetic energy. Every atom has to have exactly zero kinetic energy. So S and U are related to each other. They're related monotonically. As the internal energy increases, the entropy also increases. So they're monotonically related. It turns out, this is usually stated as a postulate actually, that the functional relationship is continuous and differentiable as well. If all those things are true, and again, it's a postulate, and so it's something that ultimately you have to check after the fact by seeing whether it agrees with nature or not. If all those things are true, then the functional relationship up there is invertible, and you can come up with a functional form for the internal energy as a function of entropy, volume, and particle number. Yeah? Question? No? Okay. So this is one of the places I wanted to get to. This relationship that I have here, whoops, I lost my screen. Okay. This relationship that I have here, this functional relationship, one function is a function of three variables, is something called a fundamental thermodynamic relation. This is the potential that we were after in the first place, and I'll say more about this in a little bit. Once you know this functional relationship, you know everything. Let's explore this functional relationship a little more, and I'll come back to that notion of fundamental relation in a little bit. Let's look at the properties of the internal energy, and this will allow us to make contact with a sort of flavor of thermodynamics or approach to thermodynamics that may be more familiar to most of you, the laws and so on. So let's look at the internal energy. If it is a function of entropy, volume, and particle number, then we can look at the change in internal energy like we have here, dUdS, dUdV, and dUdNj. And the quantities that we have, the derivative quantities that we have there, are special quantities. They're called intensive quantities. That is, they don't depend on the size of the system. The reason they don't depend on the size of the system is that U and S both do depend on the size of the system, and they both scale linearly with the size of the system. Okay? That is, with the number of atoms, for example. V also scales in the same way with the size of the system as does the number of atoms. And so by taking these derivatives, you formed intensive quantities that don't depend on the size of the system at all. So these intensive quantities play a very special role in thermodynamics, and they're given special names. We define the temperature as this, the pressure is this, and the chemical potential is this. This serves as one way to define the temperature. We'll come back to another definition of the temperature a little later. And you can show that these definitions agree with your intuitive notions of what temperature should do, and so on. Okay, so substituting these definitions of the intensive variables into our expression, then we come up with dU equals TdS minus PdV, which is the first law as one usually sees it, plus this other term, which is really important in the mantle. Often it's sort of thrown away in thermodynamics texts and physics texts, but it's really important because, as you saw in the first exercise, there's lots of phase transitions going on, the compositions are changing, all kinds of stuff is happening with the chemistry as well in the mantle, okay? And so you need to include that. And so this is a more complete first law. Actually, it's not quite complete because what happened if magnetic fields were important? Well, then you could add another term on here. What if electric fields are important? Add another term, gravitational effects and so on, all right? So this covers most of the important stuff for the mantle. We don't think magnetic fields have a big effect on physical properties or phase transitions nor electric fields. The gravitational field is another story perhaps, and that's an interesting one. Okay, so let's get back to this idea of fundamental relation. And let's see, here's a sign missing, thank you. Yes, that should be P equals minus dUdV. Okay, so here's our fundamental relation, and this is our potential from which we can derive everything else. So This single functional relationship contains complete information about all the properties, all the equilibrium states. Okay, so all the whole zoo of thermodynamic variables you can derive from the single functional relationship. And I always find it comforting that you can do this. And it's actually very important for describing the mantle, which is so complex. All you need to do is figure out this functional relationship for each species in the mantle, and you're done. Just a single functional relationship for each of your 31 or 41 or 51 species. And you're done. Now, this is a bit more specific than you might think at first. SV and NI are called natural variables of U, because when you express U in terms of those variables, you get a fundamental relation. Not any triple of dependencies will do. For example, if you decided out of temporary insanity to describe the internal energy as a function of temperature, volume, and n sub I, you'd be in trouble. That would not be a fundamental relation, and here's why. Let's plot the internal energy versus entropy, okay? And let's say you have some functional relationship like this, shown in the bold line, all right? Now, the temperature is just the slope of that line, all right? So we can calculate the temperature from this relationship. This is all at constant volume. We can calculate the temperature from this relationship, and we can plot the internal energy versus temperature, and that gives us some curve like this, okay? So now we have the internal energy as a function of temperature, all right? Now let's try to go back to this, all right? Let's see if we can recover the internal energy as a function of entropy from this information here. Well, we can't really. Because of the derivative relationship, this curve, this curve, this curve, this curve, all these curves generate the same internal energy versus temperature curve. All right, so we can go from internal energy versus entropy, we can go in this direction, but we can't go back. This graph contains less information than this graph over here. Okay, so this relationship is fundamental, this one is incomplete. Right, and what we're going to do now is look at other fundamental relations using other thermodynamic potentials that are more useful. Okay, we'll look at that in a second. First of all, this what are the steam tables? The steam tables are is a book. It's a book of the thermodynamic properties of water: heat capacity, thermal expansivity, bulk modulus, density, as a function of pressure and temperatures. Table after table after table, 200 pages of tables of numbers. All right, that's what it is. And here's the steam tables extension pack, which I guess you can buy now. The steam tables are 200 pages of tables of numbers come from a single functional relationship, the fundamental relation. Okay, so on the first page of the steam table is the fundamental relation is defined, the functional relationship is defined, and the rest of the 200 pages are just taking derivatives of that. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's. No, exactly, and that's an important point, because this statement alone doesn't tell you anything about whether you're looking at water or steam or perovskite. I mean, you have to supplement it with particular information about the material you're looking at.
I would say that thermodynamics is great, but the only thing is you have to know everything about the material at all temperatures.
Right. But this what this says is that in a way is that you don't, because you don't need to know the heat capacity, for instance, at all temperatures and pressures. All you need to know is the Gibbs free energy versus pressure and temperature in principle, and you can derive that from it. But yeah. Okay, so having a function, internal energy is a function of entropy and volume. That's not very useful, because it's really hard to control entropy in the laboratory. I don't know of a good way to do it. It also is usually rather difficult to control the volume. It's much easier to control pressure and temperature. So can we come up with another fundamental relation that's a function of more convenient variables, namely pressure and temperature? Well, it turns out you can, of course, and the process by which you do that is called the Legendre transformation. And the basic idea is very simple. We have some functional relationship here, shown in the blue line. Now we can describe that blue line in one of two ways. We can describe it as y being a function of x, all right? That's the most direct way to do it, perhaps. We could also do it another way. And, you know, why you would want to do this only becomes clear later. But another perfectly good way to describe this functional relationship is to describe, is to take the tangent to the curve at a particular point and describe the intercept of that tangent as a function of the slope of the tangent, right? That contains just as much information as y is a function of x. Now, does this remind seismologists in the audience of anything? Tau p, right? This is the tau p analysis of the travel time curve. It's exactly the same idea. What we're going to do now is identify y with our original fundamental relation, the internal energy. We're going to identify its natural variables as x, namely volume and entropy. We'll identify the new variables as pressure and temperature. Those are the ones that we want. And we'll identify phi, the new function, as the Gibbs free energy. Okay? So, from this, we can see that the Gibbs free energy is equal to U minus du dv times V minus du ds times S. And substituting in what du dv and du ds are, we get this relationship here. All right? So, G is equal to U plus PV minus TS. A relationship that you may have seen before. This is one way of deriving that relationship. Now, because in the process of this Legendre transformation, we haven't lost any information, we haven't gained any either, but we haven't lost any, and since U is a fundamental relation, G is a function of pressure and temperature, must also be fundamental. The same restrictions apply if you tried to mess around with this a little bit and express G as a function of volume and temperature, you'd be out of luck. That would not be fundamental. G only is a function of pressure and temperature as fundamental. Okay, so another way of thinking about the relationships among the various thermodynamic variables. We've looked at two thermodynamic potentials, internal energy and Gibbs free energy. Two others are also commonly used, the Helmholtz free energy and the enthalpy. We'll probably see the Helmholtz free energy in Abby's next lecture when she talks about the equation of state. Each of these has, and there are others you can find that you can define, but as Bruce said in his lecture, they are forgotten. Each one of these has natural variables, which render it as a fundamental relation. And you can arrange them all in something called a thermodynamic square. So you arrange the potentials in alphabetical order clockwise, F, G, H, U, surround them by their natural variables, U surrounded by V and S, G surrounded by P and T, F, its natural variables are V and T, and H, P and S. And you draw these arrows. And this gives you a way of remembering what the natural variables are. It also gives you a way of remembering what the derivative properties are. You can work out what the derivatives are, right? How do you do that? Okay, if you want to look at the first derivative properties, first derivatives of the potentials with respect to their natural variables, you can work it out from the square, all right? So, du dv gives you the quantity at the opposite corner of the square. P. There's a minus sign. Why? Because the result of the derivative, the arrow is pointing away from the result of the derivative. All right? So du dv is equal to minus P. If we look at another one, let's say du ds is equal to the opposite corner of the square T, and this time the arrow is pointing to the result, and so the sign is positive. Du ds is equal to T. And you can play the same game with these other guys. dg dp is equal to v, dg dt is equal to minus s, and so on. So the first derivatives fall out of this with signs and everything. The second derivatives also fall out of this, and these are what are called the Maxwell relations, something that Bruce mentioned. And the Maxwell relations just follow from the fact that the order of differentiation in a second derivative doesn't matter. Differentiation commutes. So whether you take the derivative of g with respect to p and then with respect to t, or whether you take it first with respect to t and then p, it doesn't matter. All right, so how do the second derivatives work? This is a great mnemonic device. So let's say you wanted to figure out what ds dv at constant t was. Okay, that arises sometimes. If you want to know how entropy changes with compression, for example, to figure out the adiabat in the Earth, you might want to know this. ds dv at constant t, you start at the unused corner, which in this case would be p, and go around in the opposite direction. That's the same as dp dt at constant v. It's amazing that this works, but it does. and if the arrows are related to the corners of those two circuits in the same way, the sign is positive. If they're related in different ways, it's negative. In this case, ds dv at t, the corner has an arrow point, and dp dt at v, the corner also has an arrow point, so the sign is positive. So ds dv at t is dp dt at v. And you can come up with other ones in which the one corner would have an arrow head and the other an arrow tail, and the sign would be negative. Okay? So, that's kind of nifty. Here's another way of summarizing these properties. Start with the Gibbs potential, the Gibbs free energy, right? And apply first this operator, either one, you just get the Gibbs free energy back, or take the pressure derivative or take the temperature derivative, and then apply this operator up here, okay? So apply the operator 1 to G and apply the operator 1 to G and you get G. Apply the dp dt operator to G and you get V. All right. Apply then the dt dp operator again and you get minus V on K, the bulk modulus. Okay, that's the second pressure derivative of G is minus V on K. Apply dt dp and then dt ddt and you get the thermal expansivity here. Now there's a symmetry in this matrix. It's a symmetric matrix, but I've left some of the Maxwell relations explicitly. So this is equal to this, but I've left it in this different form to emphasize one of the Maxwell relations, that these two guys are equal to each other even though it's not obvious that they should be. Right? So what I've done here is I've first taken the temperature derivative, that gives us S, then let's take the pressure derivative, so we get ds dp at t, and that's the same as dv dt at p. And if you take two temperature derivatives, you get the heat capacity. So all the second order parameters fall out of this, except the Grüneisen parameter, which is actually a combination of K, alpha, and Cp. Okay, so the nice thing about thermodynamics is that it does give you all these relationships. They're not arbitrary. It's not like the Gibbs free energy and the internal energy are completely separate quantities. They're related by Legendre transformations, as are H and F. All the other properties follow just by differentiation. Okay, let's focus in on one particular topic of thermodynamics, which is important for the mantle. We'll come back and look at physical properties more in subsequent lectures, especially the equation of state, elasticity, and so on. Let's zero in on phase equilibria, all right? One application of thermodynamics to the mantle. And let's start with some of the properties of the Gibbs free energy and why the Gibbs free energy plays this central role when you're looking at phase equilibria. Right? The Gibbs free energy is the quantity that you want to deal with when looking at phase equilibrium. Why is that? Well, let's look at how G changes in some spontaneous process holding the pressure and temperature constant. And let's first remember what the first and second laws of thermodynamics say. Du is equal to dq minus pdv. All right, that's the first law. And the second law is that the change in heat is less than or equal to TdS. It's an equality for a reversible process, and it's an inequality for an irreversible process. All right. So depending on how rapidly, for example, you heat the material. Let's work out the differential, the change in G. All right, G is equal to U plus PV minus TS. Let's work out the differential. Du plus PdV plus VdP minus TdS minus SdT. Now, take constant P and T, so that's going to drop out and that's going to drop out, and substitute the first law, and what you end up with is that the change in G is equal to the change in heat minus TdS. Now, by the second law, that difference is always less than zero, less than or equal to zero, all right? So G then must be lowered by any spontaneous process. A corollary of that is that the state with the lowest Gibbs free energy, all right, the state at which the Gibbs free energy doesn't want to change anymore, is the stable state. So there's a connection between the minimum Gibbs free energy and the stable state of the system. All right? So why is Wadsleyite stable between 410 kilometers and 520 kilometers depth in the Earth? Because it's the phase with the lowest Gibbs free energy at that range of pressure temperature conditions. So, yes? Because the phase transition can be a spontaneous process, which might be irreversible. All right, so the transition from olivine to Wadsleyite might be irreversible. That would lead to an inequality here and a lowering of the Gibbs free energy. Say if you overdrove the phase transition, if you overdrive the phase transition, the Gibbs free energy would change by a non-zero amount and it would be irreversible. Okay? And spontaneous. All right? Okay, let's look a little more at phase equilibria, the relationships between one phase and another, which is stable, where, and so on. And let's look at the differential form of the Gibbs free energy like this. So dG is equal to VdP minus SdT. And so what this relationship tells you is that the Gibbs free energy for a given phase will change with pressure and it will change with temperature. All right? It also tells you the rate at which the Gibbs free energy changes with pressure and changes with temperature. And the rate at which the Gibbs free energy changes with pressure and temperature are just given by properties of the material itself. Volume in the case of pressure changes and minus entropy in the case of temperature changes. Okay, so you can measure the quantity, the properties of a material at one condition and predict, figure out how the Gibbs free energy is going to change as you change pressure and temperature. You know exactly how it's going to change from this relationship. We can think about what kind of phases are going to be favored at conditions of elevated pressure or elevated temperature from this relationship also. Because the Gibbs free energy increases with increasing pressure, and increasing Gibbs free energy is unfavorable, that tends to make phases unstable, the phases that will be most stable at elevated pressure will be those that have the smallest volume, okay? Those whose Gibbs free energy changes least with increasing pressure, okay? So small volume, or high density, is going to be favored at high pressure, right? That's intuitive. Here we see the relationship just written out mathematically. We can also work out what kind of phases will be favored at high temperature. The Gibbs free energy decreases with increasing temperature, the minus sign there, all right? And we want the Gibbs free energy, and for stability, we want the Gibbs free energy to decrease as much as possible, right? So the phases that will be stable at high temperature will be those that have the highest entropy. again, an intuitive notion, and this is just showing that the properties of the Gibbs free energy agree with our intuition. So liquids, for example, higher entropy, are stable at high temperature. But also, among solid-solid phase transformations, we have the same sort of relationship. Perovskite is favored over ringwoodite at high temperature because it has higher entropy, because it has more floppy modes, if you like, as Abby mentioned yesterday, than ringwoodite does, and therefore higher entropy. Yes, you can derive the Clapeyron slope from this. And all I'm doing here is I'm comparing two phases with Gibbs free energy versus pressure relationships, two phases A and B, and they cross at some point, and that's where the phase transition happens. You can do the same thing versus temperature here. You can look at a variety of different pressures and temperatures, this crossing relationship, and figure out what the phase diagram is, temperature versus pressure. So A, with the large volume, therefore steep slope in this space, and low entropy, therefore shallow slope in this space, will be favored at low volumes and low temperatures, and B at higher pressures and higher temperatures. There's a relationship between, because of this, there must be a relationship between the slope of this line, the slope of this phase boundary, and the properties of the phases. And the relationship is one that Bruce showed already, and that is that the slope of that phase boundary is equal to the difference in volume divided by the difference in entropy of the two phases. So that's the Clapeyron equation, and the Clapeyron relationship. And delta V, by convention, always has the same sign. All right, if you increase pressure, the volume always decreases. You have no choice about that. The volume has to decrease. But that high pressure phase could have either higher or lower entropy. So delta S here can have either sign, and that means that the Clapeyron slope can also have either sign, exothermic or endothermic if you like, positive or negative if you like. Pressure and temperature moving the same way, or pressure and temperature moving opposite ways. The Clapeyron slope is ill-defined for a multi-component system. All this is for one-component systems. But we can still think qualitatively about how a change in temperature moves around the olivine to Wazelier transition, as we did in the laboratory exercise. Petrologists were confused about that for a while, and Dave Walker straightened them out. But it is important to keep in mind that multi-component systems are different. Okay, let's look at multi-component systems, and we'll just look at two components, and then the generalization isn't that different from the two-component case. And what we have to do first is to remind ourselves what's a phase and what's a component. All right, a phase is a material that's homogeneous in chemical composition and physical properties. A component is a chemically independent constituent of the system. So, as an example, we have olivine here. We have the olivine crystal structure. And in the olivine crystal structure, you can have, what do you have? Going back to the crystal structure, we have silicons occupying these tetrahedral sites here. And in the octahedral sites, in orange and yellow, we can have either magnesium or iron. All right? In the Earth, you tend to have about 90% magnesiums and 10% iron atoms occupying these octahedral sites. So the phase here, in this case, would be olivine. Here's our phase. It's homogeneous in chemical composition and physical properties, at least averaged over sort of many unit cells. It's going to be homogeneous. And the components are the magnesium end member and the iron end member. We might want to consider other phases too. Wazelaite and ringwoodite, those would be other phases that we would want to consider in the analysis of this system. You might ask yourself, why only two components when I have four different kinds of atoms? Why not treat magnesium, iron, silicon, and oxygen all as four independent components? And the reason is that these four elements occur in these phases only in these two combinations, so they don't vary independently. these four concentrations of these four elements don't vary independently. They only occur in these combinations. But you do have to ask yourself these questions. What are the components of the system? And you have to be careful about it, because what about the next one? What's in this dot, dot, dot here? What comes next? Perovskite and magnesium-worcestite, right? Perovskite and magnesium-worcestite comes next, all right? Now, perovskite doesn't have that composition or that composition, nor does magnesium-worcestite. So in order to treat that next phase transition, you would actually have to generalize your components to MgO, FeO, and SiO2. You'd have to add one more component to your system, or describe the compositions that you have with one more component. Okay, so those are phases and components. What about the phase rule? So given a number of components, how many phases are you allowed to have? That's what the phase rule tells you, all right? So we've got a bunch of components in the mantle. At least five are essential. Those are the number that you dealt with in the first lab exercise: magnesia, iron, silica, calcium, alumina. And of course, there are 87 others, which are much less abundant. So at least five components, and how many phases can you have of those five components? Well, it turns out you can't have an arbitrary number. You can't have 10, you can't have 20. In fact, it's quite restricted. And what you end up doing is you look at the relationships that the coexisting phases have to satisfy, and you look at how many unknowns you have and subtract one from the other, and that gives you the number of degrees of freedom, which has to be at least, which has to be positive. So the conditions that you have are that the pressure of each coexisting phase is equal, the temperatures are all equal, and the chemical potentials of every component in every phase have to be equal. All right? So we can look at the sensibility of those statements by thinking about what would happen if all the garnets were higher temperature than all the olivines. Well, that happened. Heat would diffuse from the garnets into the olivines until the temperatures were equilibrated again. All right, so the temperatures have to be equal among the coexisting phases. Also, the chemical potential of, say, FeO in the garnet has to be the same as the chemical potential of FeO in the olivine. Otherwise, you'll get flow of FeO from one of those phases to the other. So those also have to be balanced out between phases. Well, these equalities give us 2 times the number of phases minus 1 equations for the equality of pressure and temperature, and the number of components times the number of phases minus 1 for the equality of the chemical potentials. YP minus 1, because you can set all the pressures equal to that first component, and you don't have to count the first component as an additional equation. And the same for the chemical potentials here. What about the number of unknowns? You have the pressure in every phase, the temperature in every phase, that's 2p unknowns. And then you also have the chemical potentials in every phase. And once you've fixed C minus 1 of those chemical potentials, you've already fixed the last, the Cth chemical potential. So it's C minus 1 times the number of phases. So that's the number of unknowns. Subtract one from the other, gives you the number of degrees of freedom, C minus P plus 2. And so just as an example, we look at this garnet pyritide. We've got five components, four phases, olivine, orthopyroxene, clinopyroxene, garnet. And if we just work it out, the number of degrees of freedom is 3. So what does that mean? It means that, for example, we can change the pressure a little bit, and the phase assemblage, all these phases will still be present, all right? Their compositions will have changed a little bit, their phase proportions will have changed a little bit, but all these phases will still be there, we'll still have the same four phases. We can change temperature a little bit, the same four phases will still all be there. And we can change one compositional variable in addition a little bit, and the same four phases will all still be there, all right? So we can change the calcium content, we can change the iron content, magnesium content, and so on. And all four phases will still be there. Okay. Let's look at Let's continue looking at the properties of two component systems. And what we have to do first is focus in on a single phase and look at how its properties vary with composition. All right? And that will allow us then to go back and construct a two component phase diagram. So let's look at this. Let's say that we have N1 type 1 atoms, N2 type 2 atoms, and N total atoms distributed over the available octahedral sites in olivine, or you could say N1 moles of Mg2SO4 component, N2 moles of Fe2SO4 component, whatever you like. And we'll also consider the fractions of N1 and of 1 and 2 type atoms here, X1 and X2. Now, as long as the solution is ideal, then the relationships are pretty simple. The dependence of physical properties on composition is pretty simple. And this ideal solution approximation turns out to be pretty good for a lot of mantle phases. And it's an approximation, I'll just leave it at that. And so if the solution is ideal, and what it means by ideal fundamentally is that the internal energy doesn't depend on how I arrange the magnesiums and irons over the available octahedral sites. All right? So the details of the arrangement, I could switch this iron for magnesium, and the internal energy doesn't change significantly. That's what an ideal solution means. If that property is satisfied, then the volume of the olivine crystal is a linear function of the volumes of the N-member components of the solution, forsterite and phaolite, Mg2SO4, Fe2SO4, olivine. The internal energy is also a linear function of composition. The entropy, though, is nonlinear. And this is essential for understanding why solutions form in the first place. All right? There's a linear part here, all right, which depends on the entropy of the two N-members. But then there's this nonlinear part also, and where does that come from? Well, the entropy has an additional contribution, which comes from the different ways of arranging the magnesiums and irons over the available sites, all of which end up having the same internal energy. So there's a configurational entropy term, which you have to include to account for the entropy of the solid solution. Given N sites, N1 magnesiums and N2 irons, you can work out how many different ways there are to arrange the magnesiums and irons over those sites. It's a combinatorial problem. It involves factorials and so on. You end up taking the logarithm of factorials of very large numbers. And you end up with something remarkably simple. The result ends up being this. For the number of ways of arranging the atoms over the available sites and taking the logarithm of that, you just end up with that. So X1 and X2 are both less than 1, and so the logarithm of something less than 1 is a negative number, and so the contribution to the entropy then ends up being positive because of the minus sign out here, right? So the entropy of the solution is larger than a linear mixture of the N members would be. Now, increasing entropy is a good thing in terms of stability because the Gibbs free energy goes like minus TS, so the greater the entropy, the more stable the phase will be. So if we look at the Gibbs free energy now, it has a linear part here, depending on the Gibbs free energy of the two N members, plus this nonlinear part that comes from the minus TS term here. Again, this contribution is negative because X1 and X1 or X2 are both less than 1. And so if we look at the Gibbs free energy of the solution versus composition, what we find is a nonlinear relationship like this, the dark red line there. And you can compare it just to the linear term, all right, what you would get if you just took a mechanical mixture, pure forsterite crystals and pure phaolite crystals, and just threw them all into a bucket and didn't allow them to react. That's what you get for the mechanical mixture. Here's what you get for the solution. The Gibbs free energy is lower. The solution, therefore, is more stable than the mechanical mixture, and this is the fundamental reason why solutions form in the first place. It's energetically favorable to do so. Rearranging this stuff, bringing all the stuff involving X1 together and all the stuff involving X2 together, what you end up defining is the chemical potentials for the two components here. And these chemical potentials depend on composition. And here's the definition of the chemical potential here for component I. It has this constant part for the N member plus a part that depends on composition, like the logarithm of composition here. And there's this nice graphical construction. At any particular composition, the endpoints of the tangent curve give you the chemical potentials of the two N members at that composition. Now, this definition of the chemical potential does agree exactly with the definition of chemical potential that we had before, the derivative of G with respect to the number of atoms of a component. And you can show that by taking derivatives. Okay, so let's look at a two-component phase diagram. Now, phase transitions in the Earth are different from the phase transitions you usually see in thermodynamics textbooks because they occur over a range of pressures, all right, or equivalently a range of temperatures. So they're not like ice to water, graphite to diamond, a lot of the more familiar phase transitions, which occur at a single pressure, boom, all done. These occur over a range of pressures, and this is a way of illustrating why that happens. Okay, so let's consider two phases, and let's look at their Gibbs free energy versus composition. Okay, so here's Gibbs free energy versus composition for phase alpha, and here's Gibbs free energy versus composition for phase beta. You can see that both relationships have this have the same sense of curvature that we saw on the last slide. They are displaced on the Gibbs free energy axis because one of these guys is more stable at low pressure. The other is more stable at high pressure, all right? So alpha is the one that's stable under the conditions that I've drawn here. They also have slightly different average slopes, and the reason for that is that, say, the iron component goes more easily into the beta phase than it does into the alpha phase, all right? So for the beta phase, the thing is sloped like this, and for the alpha phase, which doesn't like the iron component so much, it's sloped like this. Okay, so this is what the Gibbs free energy versus composition looks like down here at low pressure where the alpha phase is the stable phase. Now let's look at what happens at very high pressures where now the beta phase is stable. The alpha phase has larger volume, its Gibbs free energy is going to increase very rapidly with pressure. Beta phase has smaller volume, its Gibbs free energy will increase more slowly. And so eventually the beta phase will become more stable, and here the beta phase has fallen below the alpha phase at high pressure, and we have this field up here where the beta phase is stable. What happens in between? The alpha curve is moving up, well, they're both moving up, but the alpha curve is moving up much more rapidly than the beta curve, and there's going to be some range of pressures over which these two curves cross, intersect, occupy the same range of pressure. And it's over that range of pressure that the phase transition occurs. So, here's an intermediate state. At this pressure here, actually, so that top graph is drawn at this pressure across here, all right? The two curves occupy an overlapping region of pressure space there, of Gibbs free energy space, sorry. And so we have the beta curve and the alpha curve, and so the two guys are coexisting at this particular pressure. They're coexisting. And one of the things we require for coexistence is that the chemical potentials of the two components be the same in the two coexisting phases. Now we know that the chemical potentials are related to the tangent to the curve, all right? So for the chemical potentials to be equal, what we need to find is a common tangent, the tangent to both curves at the same time. And that's what the dashed line gives us here, a common tangent. And from that common tangent construction, we can read off what the composition of the beta phase is and the composition of the alpha phase when they're coexisting at this particular pressure. And that gives us this point and this point on our coexistence curve. If we looked at a range of other pressures, what we would find is that the common these curves would shift relative to each other, the common tangent would shift around, defining different compositions, and we would define this phase loop here, all right? Describing the composition of alpha, the alpha phase, and the composition of beta phase when they're in equilibrium. Looked at in a different way, If we now focus on a single composition as a function of pressure, and we go up in pressure, we start out with pure alpha phase, and then we hit this phase loop, and a little bit of beta phase forms. As we keep going, more and more beta phase forms, alpha starts disappearing more and more, and then boom, here, all the alpha phase is gone, and then we have pure alpha phase above that. Right? So there's a finite range in depth for the Alving to Wadsley transition. It's a few kilometers, as we saw, a finite range of pressures or depths over which this transition takes place. If you add in the other three components, this story changes, but not in its fundamentals. The basic idea being that in a multi-component system, the two phases involved in the transition coexist over a certain finite interval of depth or pressure. Depending on the properties of the phases, they can coexist over a relatively narrow range of pressures or a very broad range of pressures. Alving to Wadsley, the coexistence region is rather narrow, a few kilometers. Pyroxene to Garnet, as you saw, is hundreds of kilometers. And I'm losing my... The reason is that the phase transition doesn't occur at a particular pressure. So dP dt is one side of the Clapeyron equation. What pressure should you choose? Should you choose the pressure halfway through the loop? Should you choose the pressure at one boundary or the other boundary of the loop? There's no obvious choice. I mean, it might be convenient to choose the point at which you have sort of half one phase, half the other, but that would be an arbitrary choice. One. Yes, and in fact, you could do that from your first laboratory exercise. I mean, you saw that as you changed temperature, the 410 moved. I mean, it changed, right? And you could take the 50% point halfway through the transition and measure how much the pressure changed, you know how much the temperature changed, and that would give you some effective Clapeyron slope. And there'd be nothing wrong with that. It just wouldn't have all the... it wouldn't have the simpler relationship to delta V and delta S that it does in a one-component system. It would be, the relationship would still be approximately true, but not exactly. Okay, I've taken a lot of time. Let me go quickly through a few others, non-ideal solutions. These are most important in that you get X solution. Magnesium perovskite, calcium perovskite have basically the same structure, in detail, slightly different. Calcium and magnesium have very different ionic radii, and so they tend to separate into different phases. And so calcium perovskite and magnesium perovskite are separate phases in the lower mantle, even though they have basically the same structure, aside from minor details of the distortions. Sorry. Same story with clinopyroxene and orthopyroxene. Okay, a few examples of measurement of phase equilibria. What these guys did, Katsura et al. In Japan, is they took a pressure vessel, filled it up with MgFe2SiO4 in different amounts, put in a pressure marker, sent an X-ray beam through the sample, and figured out what the compositions of the coexisting phases were as a function of pressure. So this is exactly the plot that we just had on the board. Now applied to the Alving to Wadsley transition, pressure versus composition, olivine and Wadsley coexisting in some loop here over a range of pressures at one temperature and at a higher temperature there. And so this is an experimental constraint on how wide that transition interval is. And these are the things that one tries to put in as accurately as possible into the thermodynamic model that you used in the first lab exercise. Oops. Okay, thermochemistry. You can measure the heat capacity versus temperature. You can integrate that using thermodynamic relations to get the entropy and the enthalpy. And the entropy is interesting because it gives you constraints on the Clapeyron slope of phase transformation. So you can get an idea from these thermochemical measurements of especially pure phases of what the Clapeyron slope of high pressure phase transitions is likely to be, with of course the caveat that in the multi-component system you have to be careful about what the Clapeyron slope means. And one other example, which will bring us to the next lecture, the equation of state, measure the volume by X-ray diffraction, the pressure by root by the change in the Ruby fluorescence spectrum, figure out what the density of perovskite is at the core mantle boundary. This is from, oh, I didn't put the reference, this is Niddle and Johnlin, 1987. Still, I think the highest pressure measurements of the density of perovskite. And Abby will go through more of the theory next time. And so the roadmap is to look at the equation of state next time and elasticity. And elasticity will require us to generalize the concept of volume to the strain tensor, pressure to the stress tensor. In the lecture after that, we'll look at statistical mechanics, more of the relationship between the macroscopic properties that we've been talking about here and the microscopic or atomic scale properties that underlie them in some sense. And in the sixth lecture, Abby will talk about, misspelling there, some of the properties of irreversible thermodynamics, which is a way of getting at the rates of processes instead of just the time-independent states of materials that we've been talking about here. Okay? I'll leave it there. Yeah? Maxwell. Yeah. Yeah, genius. I see. Uh-huh. Yeah, you would think that all of electromagnetism would have been enough, but he didn't stop there. So.